If we could go back to the 19th century, we would find that most Unitarian and Universalist congregations were in many ways different from today's 21st century Unitarian Universalism. In many ways, our 19th century forebears were the liberal Christian congregations of their time. Now, compared to most other Christian congregations, our Unitarian and our Universalist forebears tended to allow congregants a lot more room to question traditional dogma. There was a lot more emphasis on following Jesus' ethics rather than worshiping him, on deeds, not creeds. But it was well into the 20th century that Christianity became one among many world religions within most Unitarian and Universalist congregations, rather than the one most important religion. And while there are many ways in which our liberal Christian heritage continues to influence us today, and while there's plenty of room within the big tent of Unitarian Universalism to identify today as a UU Christian, there's also a sense I would invite you to consider in which Unitarian Universalism is one example of what can come after Christianity. And it's not about a better or worse, but sometimes there are things one has to go through to get somewhere else, right? To get there. Just as, in a sense, ethical humanism is an example of what can come after Judaism. But you actually probably needed Judaism to get to ethical humanism. You needed Christianity to even have any possibility of getting to Unitarian Universalism. It may or may not be whether everyone wants to go down any particular path. And while both traditional Judaism and Christianity are still obviously very much around, I've been thinking about these various trajectories that religious traditions can take recently while reading the Buddhist teacher and scholar Stephen Batchelor's latest book, After Buddhism, Rethinking Dharma for a Secular Age. In the spirit of full disclosure, it's a fairly academic book. It's published by Yale University Press, so although there's a lot that I appreciate about Batchelor's approach, be forewarned, if you're interested in some of what I say, that it is not the most accessible book for newcomers to Buddhism. If you do want accessible recommendations, talk to me afterwards. I'll give you some. For a more positive light, Batchelor's new book is a synthesis of this perspective that he's really been trying to work out over the course of about three decades of Buddhist scholarship. In 1983, he published his first book, Alone with Others, An Existential Approach to Buddhism. During the intervening three decades, just to give you a little bit of the flavor of where he's coming from, three of the titles of his books, he wrote The Faith to Doubt, and Bob talked a little bit about this earlier, but The Faith to Doubt, Glimpses of Buddhist Uncertainty, Buddhism Without Beliefs, A Contemporary Guide to Awakening, and Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. The driving question, if you kind of look through what is the driving theme that's been underneath all of those books, it's been this. What does it mean to practice the Dharma of the Buddha in the context of modernity? So just as a modern secular enlightenment perspective has led Christians on a quest for the historical Jesus, so too a modern secular enlightenment perspective has led Batchelor on what you might call a quest for the historical Buddha. Just as, I don't think this will be news to any of you, that Christ is not Jesus' last name, right? So it's Jesus of Nazareth. Christ is a title. It's from the Greek Christos. It's a translation of the Hebrew Mashiach. It means anointed one. There were a number of Christs. Come to the class if you're not sure what I'm talking about. Fan questions about the Bible. Not this Tuesday, but next. Similar, like, you know, Mahatma, that's not actually Gandhi's name, right? Mohandas Gandhi was called Mahatma. It means great soul. So in the same way, Buddha's not Buddha's name, right? Buddha is a title. It means awakened one. I would actually, and I've preached a sermon before that I won't re-preach right now, but it was actually called Becoming a Buddha and Not a Buddhist, right? The goal is actually not just to become an adherent of this dude who lived, you know, 2,500 years ago. It's to actually become an awakened one. And similar, I'd say it's not about becoming a Christian. It's about emulating something that Jesus did. It might show you a way of living in the world. So one aspect of the quest for the historical Buddha is seeking to remove these accretions of dogma, of tradition that have evolved over the years to uncover the actual teachings of the historical Buddha. So what do you find if you go back to those earliest Buddhist texts, such as the Pali Canon? So similar to early Christianity, some of the things you'll find, you might not like everything you find, but some of what you find is some surprisingly egalitarian passages that teach that all people, men or women, lay or ordained, are all equal. You see the same in some of early Christianity. And I'm not trying to say that either early Buddhism or early Christianity, you know, precisely corresponds to what we understand today in the 21st century of gender being a social construction. But in both cases, some of the most patriarchal, offensive to us passages were added after the founder's death by followers who became Orthodox hardliners and wanted to consolidate their power. All that being said, here's actually the much more radical implication that can follow from Batchelor's question of what does it mean to practice the Dharma of the Buddha in a modern secular context. It can mean that although one continues to be interested in the quest for what did the historical Buddha actually say and do, one may decide that even if, and this probably won't happen, but even if archaeologists somehow discovered tomorrow that Siddhartha Gautama was actually an unrepentant male chauvinist, that one might say, I don't care. I mean, I care, but I'm not going to stop being for gender egalitarianism, right? That's what it may mean to practice Buddhism in a modern secular context, is that one's commitment to things like gender egalitarianism are actually become more important than whatever was the case 2,500 years ago. To say just a little bit more about that, to think about where's the balance, right, between community and tradition and hierarchy and one's reason and experience. In my childhood, I was actually taught that what we should be doing is restoring the early church, that we should use scripture to reform the world to be in scriptural norms, so that scripture was in tradition as I was told that it was. Turns out it's a lot messier than all that. But that we should use that to reform the world, that this was the weight and that the modern world should be down here. In seminary, the scales got a little more even. I was actually taught you should preach with the Bible in one hand and the New York Times in the other. And so you should sort of preach at the intersection of those two things. And I think as you use, though, what happens is the scales get tipped a little more this way, in the sense that we're actually willing to say that reason and science and experience should actually be the dominant lens, and though it should be in conversation, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And all this may seem quite basic, but I actually invite you to consider how incredibly liberating it is to be told by someone who feels a tremendous weight of scripture, of dogma, of orthodoxy on their shoulders, to be told that reason and scripture and experience should be at the same or a higher level than religious tradition. Again, without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Batchelor writes, just as the term Tibetan Buddhism describes the kind of dharma that evolved in Tibet, so in its broadest sense would secular Buddhism describe the kind of dharma that is evolving in this modern age. And although many modern Asians are Buddhists who are finding themselves becoming secularized, Batchelor writes, for myself, I am a secular European finding out what it means to become a Buddhist. We might meet each other on the road, but we're actually heading in opposite directions. Just as their Buddhism is being challenged by secularity, so my secularity is being challenged by Buddhism. My concern, therefore, is as much about imagining a Buddhist secularity as about imagining a secular Buddhism. So you can sit with that koan for a little bit. Oh, what does that mean? So we have seen what happens when Buddhism becomes secularized. It's what's sometimes called McMindfulness, right? It's this sort of like, you're not really going to take Buddhism seriously. You're just going to throw in a dose to help you focus a little more at work, or, you know, be more patient with your children or your spouse. But Batchelor writes, what would happen to a secular perspective inflected by the principles and values of the Dharma in a more radical way than McMindfulness? So, speaking for myself, as someone who escaped the dogmas of Christian orthodoxy, but who is still shaped by Jesus' teaching and ethics in many positive ways that I continue to be grateful for, as I found myself also increasingly drawn to Buddhist wisdom and ethics and practice, I found myself wary of Buddhist orthodoxy and dogma. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about, go visit some traditional Buddhist communities, and you may find a surprising amount of patriarchy and orthodoxy and various things. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Having spent many years embroiled in research and debate about various theologies about, you know, what does it mean? What does Jesus' death mean? And what is this resurrection about? And all of that, many late night theological conversations and arguments. I finally came to see that such theological debates were at most a side issue for the historical Jesus. Similarly, when I started exploring the Buddhist tradition in college and from an academic perspective, I at first had a lot of concerns that if I were to ever really fully engage with Buddhism, then I guess I have to start believing in metaphysical doctrines like reincarnation and karma. Over time, I've also come to find that those debates were also not central for Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha. Just as Jesus of Nazareth actually cared much more about justice, about mercy, about building a beloved community, going out and doing those things than what you said you believed about a next world or whatever. It turns out Siddhartha Gautama cared a lot more about embracing the suffering of the world, about letting go of reactivity, and about experiencing that still, clear center from which we can respond to the world in ways no longer determined by self alone. I'll say that one more time. The Gautama talked about embracing the suffering of the world, letting go of reactivity, and experiencing that still, clear center from which we can respond to the world in ways that are no longer determined by self-interest alone. Allow me to be clear that my point is not to dissuade you from exploring the debates around atonement and resurrection, around reincarnation and karma. I'm glad to talk about all of those things, more or less glad, if you find them particularly compelling. I have a lot to say about all of those things, actually, because I've looked into them a lot. Rather, I'm inviting you to consider that these metaphysical and theological debates are optional, not central, to the Buddhist, to the earliest layers of the Buddhist and Christian traditions, especially from the perspective of their founders. It gets a lot into what the psychologist William James called the distinction between first-hand religion and second-hand religion, between what you know for yourself first-hand and second-hand talk about what other people have told you is the case. And that having those first-hand discussions saying, let me tell you about some of what I've actually experienced when I've meditated, that's totally different than second-hand debates about reincarnation and karma. So that anyway, pay attention to that when you're getting these debates. Are we having a first-hand discussion or a second-hand discussion? Are we caring more about deeds or more about creeds? Along these lines, considering the following insight from Batchelor, he says that the core teachings of Siddhartha Gautama, no longer tied to the religious dogmas and the institutions of Asian Buddhism, might actually help encourage the dawning of a culture of awakening, which may or may not call itself Buddhist. I've been reflecting on this perspective a lot recently since the practice community that I've been a part of for about a decade now has recently shifted its name from Buddhist Geeks, you know, I would be drawn to something called Buddhist Geeks, right, to meditate.io. Buddhist Geeks lasted from around 2006 to 2016 and included a popular podcast downloaded more than 10 million times. You can still find it on iTunes, but they're not making any more of them. A central question for Buddhist Geeks was, how can we serve the convergence of Buddhism with rapidly evolving technology in an increasingly global culture? I benefited a lot from being part of exploring that question, but similar to Stephen Batchelor's perspective in After Buddhism, the creators of Buddhist Geeks have now chosen to experiment with dropping the name Buddhism from their newest incarnation of meditate.io. While still influenced by, still very much interested in the Buddhist tradition, the focus is being clear that our interest is not centrally about theory. Our interest is centrally about pragmatic issues of practice. You know, how to meditate and how to teach meditation in a 21st century globalized, pluralistic, postmodern world. Now, there's a lot more to say about all that, and certainly there are many other significant ways, both contemporary and ancient, of exploring the Buddhist tradition in today's world, but I wanted to just share a little bit with you of where my practice is and how it's evolving. But a related part of what I've learned, and I'd be interested to know if this is true for you or not, part of what I've learned about myself over the years is it's a lot easier, at least for me, to read a book about Buddhism or to talk about Buddhism than it is to practice Buddhism. That dynamic is sometimes called seeking salvation by bibliography. And although I benefited immensely from studying the Buddhist tradition, and I think it's helped me to avoid ways of practicing that are maybe not as helpful in our 21st century world, I'm seeking a balance these days between secondhand study or talk about Buddhism and cultivating firsthand experiences with meditation. In that spirit, I want to take just a few minutes this morning to invite you to actually do some Buddhism, to do some meditation. So developed from a secular perspective, this is from a smartphone app called Buddhify. That is, if you want to try to integrate Buddhism into your world. So this is a meditation on that app, Buddhify, by my meditation teacher, Vincent Horn. So if you're comfortable doing so, I invite you to take a moment and take a deep breath in and let it go. Begin relaxing your body, giving your places in your body that need to relax. Pay some attention to them and let them relax. Relax your mind, and if you're comfortable doing so, I invite you to close your eyes. Sitting up, relaxed but alert, let your attention settle on that inner movie theater of your mind, the screen of your imagination. How we experience the universe affects how we experience ourselves. And I would like to invite us to explore two ways of experiencing the observable universe. The first way will be ourselves arising within the cosmos. The second way as all conscious experience arising within our awareness. By meditating in this way, we gain a deeper familiarity with two of the most core ways of knowing reality. One more Western scientific, one more Eastern and contemplative. We'll begin with the universe you probably know best, the physical one. On that screen of your mind, picture yourself in this room that we are in, just as it is. Imagine the setting, the layout. Feel yourself supported by your chair. Feel yourself inhabiting this space, this room, and with the other people around you. Now allow the picture in your mind to expand to include Frederick County, perhaps as an aerial shot. See how much space you take up in this space, how much smaller you are from this perspective. Now expand your imagination even further to the larger region, and then to the larger expanse of the continent of North America. Notice where you are in this picture. Now we're going to allow the aerial shot to go all the way into space. Imagine seeing Earth from the perspective of the International Space Station. See where you are on this planet Earth. Notice how vast this big blue marble is. Now expand even further out, moving away from the sun, past Mars and Jupiter, the rest of the planets in our solar system. See the sun shrinking into a smaller dot and Earth starting to vanish from sight. Take in the whole system from the very edges of our solar system, vast open space in us, sitting on planet Earth, not even visible now, but still hurtling around our small sun. Now allow your mind's eye to zoom even further out still, moving much faster than the speed of light. Go all the way back to the point where you're taking in the whole of our Milky Way galaxy. Take in all 3 billion or so points of light that make up the luminous core and the spiraling arms of the Milky Way. How much space do you take up at this scale? Continue zooming out. Take in the Virgo supercluster, a grouping of tens of thousands of galaxies, including our own Milky Way. Notice the self-similar pattern of organization even at this scale, shining points of matter and light coming together with vast distances of space in between. Continue zooming out, watching innumerable galaxies stream by. Take in all the known universe, which the latest research tells us contains more than 2 trillion galaxies, 10 times more than was thought even a year ago. 2 trillion galaxies. Notice how inconceivably small you are from this vantage point. What does this bring up in you? Notice it. Awe, fear, confusion, wonder. Notice how seeing yourself as a tiny part of the vast cosmos changes your experience. Now, during this whole thought experiment, of course, every single thing we've imagined has been in your mind. You imagined your way to the outer edges of space through a series of thoughts. And notice that as you sit here, not only are thoughts arising in your awareness, but so is every other aspect of your awareness. Notice, even with your eyes closed, sights arising in your experience. Sounds arising in your awareness. Smells arising in your awareness. Tastes arising in your awareness. The sensations of your body arising in your awareness. They're all washing through your experience. Waves of thought and emotion course through this field of sensory experience. Arising, persisting for a while, then changing. Notice how not a single thing arises outside of your experience. All of this is happening in your awareness. Every single thing we have ever thought, felt, and known has arisen within this human experience of ours. See what it's like to take in the entire observable universe as what's currently arising in and as your awareness, and then passing away. Anything you can imagine as being outside of it, including the vast magnitudes of space, arises as a thought within this experience. We are the universe knowing itself. Beginning to reflect on this meditation, take note of what has it been like to imagine yourself as a small part of the vast physical universe. How did that contrast with experiencing the whole of the universe as that which is arising in your experience right now? How can these two different perspectives help illuminate more of who we are and the universe we inhabit? As we prepare to end this meditation, see if you can feel what it's like to toggle between these two modes of experiences. There's this ancient story of two ordained Buddhist male monks who were walking through the woods and came to a river that a woman was having trouble getting across. She was much smaller than they were, and they said, ma'am, do you need some help? One of them said, ma'am, do you need some help getting across the water? And she said, that would be very helpful, thank you. So they helped her across the water, one of them did, and then a few miles later, when they were separated again, one turned to the other and said, brother, I can't believe you touched a woman. That's against your vows. And he said, brother, I carried that woman across the river. You're the one still carrying her. So invite you know, thinking about that innovation and tradition. So as you continue your journey related to the traditions from which you come, both family, religious, and otherwise, what does it mean to continue your journey with love, to care for one another and to care for this one earth, to do justice and to make peace? And as you go, whatever taste or touch you've had of hope, of love, or peace, or joy in this time and place, that goes with you into the world. So live boldly and with thanksgiving.